Eric Larson's best-selling book, The Devil in the White City, tells the true story, and it is a true story, of two men in Chicago in 1893. The first man is Daniel Burnham, considered by many to be the greatest architect of his day. Burnham was the driving force behind the Chicago's World Fair in 1893, and in less than 2 years, Burnham supervised the construction of over 200 buildings that covered a square mile along the coast of Lake Michigan for the celebration of the World's Fair. In a span of 6 months, the fair attracted 27.5 million visitors. Now, that's at a time in 1893 when the entire population of the United States was only 65 million. So this was a phenomenal success, an achievement that people said was unparalleled in the beauty of the architecture and the size and scope of the exhibits. The second man featured in Larson's book is Dr. H.H. Holmes. He was not known before the fair, but in the year before the fair, Holmes constructed a block-long, three-story building nearby that served as the exact opposite of Daniel Burnham's architectural genius. Included in this monstrosity were a soundproof vault, several gas chambers, and a specially crafted furnace designed to eliminate all odors emanating from the building. He called it the World's Fair Hotel, and he attracted visitors to it who never came out. When it was all said and done, Holmes confessed to the murders of 27 men, women, and children, but investigators believed the number was far, far higher. In fact, they eventually traced over 50 women alone who had entered that hotel never to come out. Holmes, in his confession, stated, "I was born with the devil in me. I could not help the fact that I was a murderer, no more than the poet can help the inspiration to sing." The story of The Devil in the White City is Larson's attempt to deal with this issue, where in humanity we have wonderful, beautiful accomplishments right beside horrible, atrocious evil. And how can that be? Even when we achieve our highest dreams, our highest ambitions, our highest potential as human beings, there is evil in our midst. There is evil in this world. And God routs evil at Armageddon. Satan is alive and well in this world. He is real. And in spite of our many accomplishments, evil abounds. When Robinson Crusoe's Good Man Friday asked him, "Why doesn't God just destroy the devil?" Good question. Robinson Crusoe gave him the right answer, the only answer, the great answer, the Christian answer. God will destroy him. That's the Christian response to evil. And the question of evil is a huge philosophical question that people deal with. The Christian response to evil is God will destroy it. We don't deny it. We don't stick our heads in the sand and ignore evil. We don't placate evil. We don't think we can just say nice words and evil will just go away in this world. We know evil exists. Evil lives in human hearts. Revelation chapter 19 this morning. Now I know we've gone through most of Revelation now, and we've seen a lot of horrible images in the book of Revelation and attempted to understand what God is telling us about the future of this age. And in Revelation 19, as we continue our study this morning, God tells us that when Christ returns to this earth, He will finally rid this world of evil. God routs evil in the Battle of Armageddon. Principle number one this morning, God knows the outcome before the battle. Revelation 19, verses 17 and 18. And I saw an angel standing in the sun, and he cried out with a loud voice, saying to all the birds which fly in middle heaven, come, assemble for the great supper of God, in order that you may eat the flesh of kings, and the flesh of commanders, and the flesh of mighty men, and the flesh of horses, and of those who sit on them, and the flesh of all men, both free and slaves, and small and great. Now, I don't know if the message is really going to be that long this morning, Roger, but some might say it's for the birds. God sends out a great invitation through His angel to all the birds that are flying in middle heaven. And God invites the birds to gather for the great dinner of God. The birds, He said, will feast on the bodies of all who follow Satan in this ultimate battle against God. God knows the outcome before the battle ever begins. Satan and his followers have no chance against God. One of the great themes of Revelation is the absolute sovereignty of God. He is in control. There are no surprises to Him in this world. Now, in Revelation, in these verses, there are two dinners predicted in chapter 19. In verse 9, there's the dinner of God, which is a wedding feast for believers. And in verse 17, the text we just read, the dinner of God is a judgment feast for the vultures. So John paints a picture starkly contrasting these two dinners of God. Followers of Christ will enjoy eating the wedding feast celebrating Christ's love for us. We have just sung of that. Followers of Satan will be eaten as the vultures feast celebrating Christ's judgment, His justice. So the second coming of Christ, which was in the preceding verses in Revelation 19, has two very opposite results for humanity. Believers celebrate. We will have a great party, a feast such as we have never experienced. We will enjoy the perfect love of our matchless Savior. But unbelievers will be judged. Unbelievers will face the awful consequences of not following Christ. You see, with Jesus, there's no middle ground. There's no on the fence. There's no maybe one way, maybe another way. What we do with Jesus in this life now is the key to what He does with us when He comes back. These are huge eternal issues. Follow Him now or face Him then. The choice is the most important choice that any man, woman or child makes in this life. You are either for Him or against Him. And the book of Revelation draws this very stark line between those who are for Him and those who are against Him, all the way through the book. Now God invites the birds to gather and feast on the flesh of kings and commanders, of strong soldiers and horses. They will eat the flesh of all, God says, both free and slave, both small and great. God is no respecter of persons in His judgment of humanity. I take it that the all here does not mean all people on the earth at this time, but all who are part of the armies of Satan. that are drawn up against Christ when Christ returns. This particular judgment relates to those who are actively following Satan in the Battle of Armageddon. Now, there are those, certainly, who argue that this should be understood figuratively and not literally. In the same way, they say that the woman in chapters 17 and 18 of Revelation is not a real woman, but a figure of speech. And we noted there that she was a figure of speech. How do we decide in Revelation what to take literally and what to take figuratively? Sometimes it's tough. Basically, I've said before that the rule of thumb is we let the plain sense be the true sense unless it has no sense, it makes no sense, or unless it's nonsense. So we apply to every text, we look at it to see if the plain sense makes good sense. And if it's nonsense, then we look for the figurative sense to this passage. The woman in chapter 17 and 18, for example, we are told in that passage that she's not a woman. We're told by John that she is a figure for the city. She is the city of Babylon and stands for all that the Babylon stood for. So we know that's a figure of speech. The feast in Revelation 19 doesn't have any qualifier like that. It is a description that emphasizes the literal aspects of a battle. And it makes perfectly good sense that after a violent battle, the vultures would feast on the dead bodies. It happens in every war. So we take this description at face value because there's no qualifier to indicate otherwise. The wording in this passage actually comes from an Old Testament prediction made by Ezekiel the prophet in Ezekiel chapter 39, 600 years before Christ came to this earth. The prophet was predicting in Ezekiel 39 a great battle when the Messiah returns to this earth and protects Israel. And God tells Ezekiel in chapter 39 in verses 17 and 18, "Son of man, this is what the sovereign Lord says, call out to every kind of bird and all the wild animals, assemble and come together from all around to the sacrifice I am preparing for you, the great sacrifice on the mountains of Israel. There you will eat flesh and drink blood. You will eat the flesh of mighty men and drink the blood of the princes of the earth as if they were rams and lambs and goats and bulls, all of them fattened animals from Bashan." So Revelation 19 is built on this prophecy from Ezekiel 39 that John was certainly very familiar with and that his readers were very familiar with. God knows the outcome before the battle begins. It is no contest. Satan has no chance, and all who follow Satan will be destroyed in this great battle. And the ultimate humiliation, which was true in the ancient Near East, it was horribly shameful to leave a body unburied and to have the birds come and destroy and eat that body. That was the ultimate shame of any battle in the Middle East. And of course, that's the point here, that this is a horribly shameful event for Satan's followers, as the bodies are left to rot and decompose in the land of Israel. Second principle then. Not pleasant fare, I realize, for Sunday mornings. God crushes Satan in the battle. Verse 19. "And I saw," and remember, throughout these sections, there are eight "and I saws" that show us the structure of the book of Revelation here as we close it. They are all part of the seventh bowl judgment. "And I saw," I think this is the third one. Yes, it is the third one. "And I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies assembled to make war against him who sat upon the horse and against his army. And the beast was seized, and with him the false prophet who performed the signs in his presence by which he deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who had worshipped his image. These two were thrown alive into the lake of fire which burns with brimstone. And the rest were killed with the sword, which came from the mouth of him who sat upon the horse. And all the birds were filled with their flesh. Now once again, when we read it the way we would read any piece of literature, the way we would read the newspaper. We're looking for the face value unless there's some indication that we shouldn't take it at face value. And here we are told of this great battle that will take place at the end of this age. And it will take place in the land of Israel. Operation Iraqi Freedom. As that battle raged, although that war raged, Muhammad al-Sahaf, Iraq's Minister of Information, daily stood and refuted evidence that Iraq was losing the war. Maybe you remember him on the news. He was frequently on the news. On April 6th, after coalition forces seized Baghdad Saddam Airport, renamed it Baghdad International Airport, started flying planes in and out, and ventured into Baghdad itself, the Miami Herald quoted al-Sahaf as saying, "We butchered the force present at the airport." On April 7th, after U.S. troops penetrated central Baghdad and stormed Saddam's Republican palace, the Washington Post quoted al-Sahaf as saying, "There is no presence of the American columns in the city of Baghdad at all. We besieged them and we killed most of them." And you remember probably watching the news and how farcical it seemed. This man was saying things and then they'd show us clips of what was actually happening. He was referred to as Baghdad Bob by the media. His efforts to explain away coalition force victories as illusions were comical, really. But folks, in the same way, Satan will continue to spread his lies, his deception, right to the very bitter end as Christ returns and as people see Christ returning. For this is what Satan does best. He is the master deceiver, the master liar. And many will be deceived by him in that day. The Middle East has always been the center point, the flashpoint, ground zero for Satan's plans on this earth, because Jerusalem has been at the center of God's heart for this world. Down through history, Satan has always tried to rule this part of the world. And in the end, Christ will meet Satan in open battle right here. Remember, the book of Revelation is all about spiritual warfare for this world. We call this the Battle of Armageddon, but it really would be more accurately called the War of Armageddon. For it is not a single event, as we piece together the various prophecies, but a series of troop movements and battles that culminate in the return of Christ on the Mount of Olives to destroy Satan. The battles continue to rage in our day, or are raging in our day. That's why so much of the world's attention is often placed on the Middle East. There are constantly battles raging there. There have been battles raging there from the beginning of human history, really. Why? Because it is the flashpoint. This is ground zero for the battle between Satan and God. Now, in the battle between Satan and God, it is not dualism. There are not two equal forces. God is always sovereign. In this battle, all down through history, now he is sovereign. And Satan only does what Satan is allowed to do in this world. Bible prophecy teaches us that it is here that the final battles for the future of earth will take place as well. And Satan will lie, Satan will deceive the leaders of this world until he meets his end by the power of Christ right here. By the way, that's why Christians ought to be praying for the leaders of this world. For Satan's deceptions are powerful. And he will deceive the leaders of this world. He will move and work in the political powers and the military powers of this world to get what he wants done at the end of this age. All right, let's take a look at what we can learn about this great war from the Bible. And I can only quickly summarize. There's a lot of material here, and I'm not going to go into a lot of current events or newspaper stories. I know they're out there, and the European Union and the Common Market and Turkey and some of these stories are out there right now. You take it and apply it, all right? I'm just going to teach you the principles here about what happens, and then you focus. And think about that in the days ahead. The first principle is that God faces Satan's armies at the end, verse 19. And I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies assembled, they're gathered to make war against him who sat upon the horse and against his army. So who gathered the armies of the earth together for this battle? Now, nothing happens without God, of course, or without God's allowance. But we're told earlier in Revelation chapter 16, we're told who gathered. Revelation chapter 16 and verse 13, and I saw coming out of the mouth of the dragon and out of the mouth of the beast and out of the mouth of the false prophet three unclean spirits like frogs, for they are spirits of demons performing signs which go out to the kings of the whole world to gather them together for the war of the great day of God the Almighty. Behold, I am coming like a thief. Blessed is the one who stays awake and keeps his garments, lest he walk about naked and men see his shame. And they gathered them together to the place which in Hebrew is called Harmageddon. So, this is the unholy trinity of Revelation. The dragon is Satan. The beast is his political, military leader on earth, and the false prophet is his religious leader on earth. And demons, unclean spirits, are sent out from them to the kings of the earth to gather them into a place called Harmageddon. Now, don't think that the political leaders of this world are going to see frogs coming at them. This is John's, God is pulling back the curtain to show John what will take place. But the demons will be very active at the end of this age. And they will affect the political leaders and they will gather them for this great battle in northern Israel. Because the place of Harmageddon is the valley of Megiddo in northern Israel. And they will unite there apparently in an intent to conquer the city of Jerusalem by force. And it is at this battle, the battle of Armageddon, where Christ will return to face these armies. Zechariah chapter 14 tells us that. He will stand on the Mount of Olives and he will protect his people, the Israelites, and he will defend the city of Jerusalem in that day. Now, all of this information is based upon a very famous prophecy in the Old Testament, in Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39. And I've put up here a modern map of the Middle East so that we can think a little bit about what the Bible predicts will take place at the end of this age. I said earlier that the banquet of the birds is drawn from the passage, Ezekiel 38 and 39, and all of this information is also based upon that passage. So, let's take a very quick summary look at Ezekiel 38 and 39 so that we can kind of understand what is going to happen and what John is talking about here in the gathering of these armies. I believe that Ezekiel 38 and 39 is the description of this war of Armageddon. And if we superimpose the place names from Ezekiel's prophecy as he would have known them, onto a modern map of the Middle East, we'll get a better idea of who the major players are in this final great battle. The leader is a man in Ezekiel named Gog from the land of Magog. Now, the Magogites have been identified by historians as the Scythians who lived in what is modern Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, and Kazakhstan. They were a warlike group in Ezekiel's day, and who by the time that Ezekiel prophesied, they were well known and had conquered the land around the Caspian and Black Seas all the way north to what is modern-day Ukraine. The Scythians became a menace to both the Greeks and the Romans in the years after Ezekiel because they were such a great the powerful military culture. They were the first to perfect cavalry. They were great horsemen and warriors, and they were feared all over the Middle East. Now, you may have heard preachers say that Russia is the leading nation of this end-time war. The passage in Ezekiel 38 uses the word Rosh, which is a modern word for Russia. The problem is that it's based on faulty linguistics to identify it with Russia. The modern word for Rosh, which was used today for Russia, came actually from the Vikings in the Middle Ages who brought it into that land and that area. It was never used of this region before that time, and certainly had no connection to Ezekiel, who lived 1,500 years earlier than the first use of Rosh for the country of Russia. The word Rosh is a Hebrew word originally, and in Ezekiel's day it simply meant chief. In fact, there's no indication of a place name called Rosh, or very little indication of any place name called Rosh. It simply meant chief, and if you read the King James Version, they translate it as chief. So the passage should be understood as Gog from the land of Magog, the Scythian hordes, tribal powers, chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. And then it goes on to describe the allies. Now, when you take a biblical atlas and you take a look at this area, you will find these place names. They were well known in Ezekiel's day. You can take an atlas and trace them. Meshech and Tubal were located in, well, it would be eastern Turkey now, and Tagarma was in the region of Armenia. Gomer, these were the Cimmerians who had come into the region of northwestern Turkey today. Persia, of course, Iran. Put was the country of Libya in ancient times. Kush was the Ethiopians and all who lived in Africa south of that region. So, what do I conclude from this? I conclude that the final war, the Great Battle of Armageddon, will primarily be a Middle Eastern war. It will draw upon the traditional hatreds that exist there. It may well draw in other powers such as Russia or the United States. But it is primarily these countries and these ethnic groups. And it is, I think, wrong to say that the war is led by Russia. I mean, if you look at the area today, the region is a hotbed of anti-Semitism, isn't it? Many of these countries are outrightly opposed to Israel and seek its total elimination from the face of this earth. So we ought to be watching carefully these nations and their ethnic hatreds for the nation of Israel, because that is the background for this final world war as the armies are gathered together. And Christ will intervene as these nations, along with others, seek to finally eliminate Israel from the face of this earth. But it won't happen. That's the good news. It won't happen because Christ will return. And when Christ returns, we learn that God seizes Satan's leaders in verse 20. And the beast was seized, and with him the false prophet who performed the signs in his presence by which he deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who had worshipped his image. These two were thrown alive into the lake of fire which burns with brimstone. So, the leaders here of this coalition of armies are not killed in the battle. These two living ones, literally, are thrown into the lake of fire, we're told. In other words, Christ captures them alive, and they are thrown into the lake of fire alive. By the way, the lake of fire, and not hell, is the final resting place for all those who are judged by God. We will look at that when we come to the end of Revelation 20. So two of the unholy Trinity are thrown into the lake of fire. They are seized and they are thrown into the lake of fire at the end of the War of Armageddon. The dragon or Satan, the leading member of this unholy trinity, is not thrown into the lake of fire at this time. We learn in Revelation 20 that he is seized and he is imprisoned for 1,000 years. And after that, in Revelation 20, Satan is released for one last horrible attempt to deceive the people of this world. And only after another great battle with God is Satan thrown into the lake of fire. Because then in Revelation 20 and verse 10 we read, "And the devil, who deceived them, was thrown into the lake of burning sulfur, where the beast and the false prophet had been thrown. And they will be tormented day and night forever and ever." So Satan and his leaders will eventually spend eternity in this place of torment. The beast and the false prophet were thrown into the fire alive at the end of the War of Armageddon. Satan will be thrown into the lake of fire later in Revelation 20. But what about the rest of Satan's followers, all those members of the armies? Well, they are not thrown into the lake of fire at this time. Look at Revelation 19:21. God kills Satan's followers. "And the rest were killed with the sword which came from the mouth of him who sat upon the horse, and all the birds were filled with their flesh." So God kills Satan's followers. I take it that when the text says the rest were killed with the sword, that John is talking about the rest of the soldiers in Satan's armies, not the rest of the people in this world. All of the soldiers in the armies were killed. They were not thrown into the lake of fire. They were killed to await judgment later at the great white throne judgment of God, just like all unbelievers of all ages will face God eventually in that judgment. So, Christ kills them. We who are a part of his army do not kill them. Christ does. It is an execution. The text is very clear that they are killed by the sword that comes out of the mouth of the one sitting on the white horse, and that is Christ. So there is a great slaughter at Armageddon. Now, many people don't like that image. It's not our favorite image of Christ either, is it? It's a horrible image of Christ in many ways. Many want only a Christ who is kind and gracious, always forgiving, always loving. But Christ is also just. And Christians are called to worship God for his justice as well. And that involves judgment. And judgment is very real. Christ must eliminate evil from this creation. And these are men who have gone beyond the point of redemption from evil. Do you understand the horror of that statement that I just made? To be beyond the redemption of God? That's a horrific statement. A person can give himself over to evil until evil takes over him. And evil is not something to be placated or appeased. At some point, that person is no longer redeemable even by God. That's justice. These followers of Satan, evil can only be eliminated by death, destruction in the end. They were so deceived that they became evil, or become evil. And you know what? It is the same with people today. There are evil people in this world because they follow and are deceived by an evil person, Satan. This is the only explanation for evil that makes philosophical sense. Philosophers, academicians, intellectuals want to ignore evil. But you can't ignore evil. It's real in this world. And this kind of evil can only be eliminated and ultimately will only be eliminated when God finally judges Satan in the end. And God proves Satan's impotence. Satan is real. Satan is alive. He is at work in our world and has been since the beginning of history. Satan is the author of evil. And one of Satan's grand deceptions is to get people to believe that he is all-powerful, that he is more powerful than anything else in this world, and that he can provide whatever a person wants, whatever a person needs in this life. But it's a lie. It's a deception. And here at the very end, Jesus proves Satan's impotence. Satan is really weak. He's beaten. He has no power beyond what God allows him to have. Now, we can discuss why does God allow him so much power. That's a different question. But he has no power unless God allows him power. He is weak. He is impotent. And here at the end, everybody who followed him finds out just how weak and impotent Satan is. But boy, doesn't Satan grab lies, doesn't he? Even today. And controls with deception and lies. And yet he is weak. And all the birds were filled with their flesh. Literally, the text says they were fattened on the flesh of these soldiers from Satan's armies. It's the Feast of the Vultures. What a disgusting and humiliating picture. It is a picture of Satan's true power, or really lack of it. The world will one day learn what all Christians should know already. Satan can do nothing unless Christ lets him. That is a basic principle for our lives today and how we live in this world. Now, why is that important to know? Why did John give us all this information? Why did God give us all this information? Why study the end of this world and the judgment of Satan? Well, Robert McFarlane said in a sermon, "The church speaks the language of the end so that we will know just how high the stakes are in the present." The church speaks the language of the end so that we will know just how high the stakes are in the present. Our end game is to ride those white stallions in the army of Christ. It's a glorious end game. Satan's end game, and the end game for all who follow Satan, is the lake of fire. Those are pretty high stakes. Our reality is we win with Christ. The world's reality is that this world is filled with evil that will lose when Christ returns. Those are pretty high stakes. Our reality is we will live forever in joy and celebration of Christ's love, in perfection, in beauty, in glorious, wonderful experiences. The world's reality, apart from Christ, is that they will spend eternity in the lake of fire. That's a huge stake. But do we live as if those are really the stakes? Not just for ourselves, but for those around us? I don't think so. Not most of the time. Most of us don't want to think that way. And yet as you walk out of here this morning, and you drive, and you go into your homes, and you go into your streets, and you go into those stores, guess what? Those are the stakes. Gary Eaton loaned me a book that I've been reading on leadership, actually, in the business world. In that book is an interesting account of an interview that the author, Jim Collins, had with Admiral Jim Stockdale. Admiral Stockdale was the highest-ranking U.S. officer in what was called Hanoi Hilton, the prisoner of war camp during the height of the Vietnam War. He was tortured over 20 times during his eight-year imprisonment from 1965 to 1973, and he devised all sorts of ways to help his men survive and stay strong under brutal conditions in that prisoner of war camp. After his release, he was given the Congressional Medal of Honor for his courage and leadership during those years. And Jim Collins interviewed him on the campus of Stanford University, where he works today. He asked him how he could deal with all of the suffering when he didn't know how it was all going to end while he was going through that experience. "I never lost faith in the end of the story," Admiral Stockdale replied. "I never lost faith in the end of the story." That's how he could survive it. He went on to say, "I never doubted not only that I would get out, but also that I would prevail in the end and turn the experience into the defining event of my life, which in retrospect I would not trade." They were silent for several minutes as Stockdale limped across the campus, moving slowly because of the injuries suffered in that torture. And then Collins asked, "Who did not make it out? Who didn't make it out?" "Oh, that's easy," he said. "The optimists. The optimists. They were the ones who said, 'We're going to be out by Christmas.' And Christmas would come and Christmas would go, and they'd say, 'We'll be out by Easter.' And Easter would come and Easter would go, and they'd say, 'Well, it's Thanksgiving and it's Christmas.' And they died of a broken heart." There was another long pause, and then Admiral Stockdale said, "This is a very important lesson. You must never confuse faith that you will prevail in the end, which you can never afford to lose, with the discipline to confront the most brutal facts of your current reality, whatever they might be. You can never confuse faith in the end of the story with the discipline to face the brutal facts of your current situation." That is a biblical message. Where it is the message of endurance for every Christian in this life. Brothers and sisters, that is the key to biblical endurance. Don't confuse faith that you will win in the end with the hard discipline of facing the reality of suffering and struggle today. That was Revelation's message to the believers there in the first century in modern, what is now modern Turkey. For they were facing that struggle. Christians have to face up to the hard realities of this life. We don't lie to ourselves. We don't pretend that it's going to go away. We don't hide our heads in the sand. We face the hard struggles, whatever those struggles might be for you this morning, you face up to them. They are real. They hurt. There's pain. But we never lose sight of the end of the story, because that's victory. And that's the only way to endure for Christ in this world. Father, help us to understand that you don't eliminate the struggles today. And as much as we pray often for the elimination of those struggles, they are real. But we know the end of this story. And we know that you judge all evil and you judge all sin. We know that we will celebrate with you forever because of your love for us. We have accepted you. We rejoice in that love, and it holds us through the tough times we face today. And that one day we will celebrate for you, forever with you. In Jesus' name, and because of what he's done.